The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of me and or my ma, and we do not mean to offend. Warning, most names have been changed, dates might be a bit off, and general facts might be a bit exaggerated. So if you're picky, this might not be for you, because the point is that it's a good story. If you haven't heard already, season one is being re-released in anticipation for season two of Coffee with My Ma. Today's episode is part two of episode two. So if you haven't listened to episode two yet, I suggest you go back and take a listen to catch up. If you haven't checked out our new look yet on our website, I suggest you go and do that too. There you'll find all of our links to the social media pages at www.coffeewithmyma.com. And nyawakoa to our sponsor, Moccasin Joe Coffee, an indigenous family-owned and operated company from Gunnisadage. Their coffee is amazing. And nyawa to Canada Council for the Arts for making season two of Coffee with My Ma possible. So here is episode three from season one of Coffee with My Ma, which originally aired May 17th, 2018. Welcome to episode three, part two of Ma Gets Fired a Few Times. I hope you all enjoyed part one. Today's stories are a little more intense, but first things first. Okay, so did you all get a chance to see the one and only Gandinata Horn, aka Ma of Coffee with My Ma, burst in on the Assembly of First Nations in Ottawa a couple weeks ago and give them all shit? If not, you can find it online and on our social media. For those of you who don't know what AFN is, it's basically just a faction of the government, a sort of disguise so that our people think these appointed quote-unquote chiefs are looking out for what's best for us all. Right. I don't really want to talk about what she said. I'm more interested in what she did. So I was in a car on my way to Toronto when my cousin texted me saying my mom was in Ottawa and just gave AFN shit, and there's video of it. Jesus, did my anxiety skyrocket or what? What did she say? How long was it? Who was she with? Did she get arrested? How did she get there? Did she look beast or was she in her gardening clothes? So many questions, right? Being daughters of this strong-willed, outspoken woman, these instances are not new to us. Okay, we have learned to deal with it in our own individual ways, and it's gotten easier as we've gotten older. You know what? Actually, it's pretty hard to describe what being daughters of a radical political native rights activist is like, and I'm trying my best here, okay? Ma raised us to think for ourselves, and sometimes even we don't agree with her. But my point is, this woman is old school, all right? This woman has been on this earth for almost 80 years. She is a survivor of colonialism. She has been witness to so many important events in not only world history, but very big events in Indian country that have affected every single Ngwenhuwa person on Turtle Island, whether you like it or not. People have, and still do, call her crazy. But I'll tell you something. My sisters, nieces, and nephews and I sit with her all the time and chat. This woman is not crazy. She has all her wits about her. Like I said, she's old school. And sometimes we need a bit of that old school flair to shake things up. She went into AFN and snatched that microphone to remind us that this minister is not our friend. This minister is still in charge of an act that is meant to destroy our communities, and I know she's not the only person who thinks that. She's taught us that if you know in your spirit that something is not right, speak up, because you can't sit back and expect someone else to do it for you. All right, so moving on. So like I said, today's story is a little more intense. The first story is kind of gut-wrenching, and the second story, however, has a few layers, but touches on an event I hope most of you have heard of, the Oka Crisis of 1990. If you haven't, Google it, but the PC version is, the municipality of Oka, Quebec, Canada, wanted to expand their golf course from 9 holes to 18, right over one of our community's burial grounds, which resulted in a 78-day standoff involving the Mohawks and allies against the Sûreté du Québec, our provincial or state police, and eventually the Royal 22nd Regiment of the Canadian Army, otherwise known as the Vandoos. My mom, my sister and I were involved in the standoff in Conesadague, along with many other men, women, and children. Anyways, the second story in this episode is a bit of insight into what led to my family's involvement. And it was the time my mom got fired where it wasn't really a laughing matter. All right, let's get started. This is part two of Ma Gets Fired a Few Times, Foreman Dixon to the Rescue, and When Indian Affairs Canada Really Doesn't Want You Around.
I always like that story, the one where you worked and you got that job and you couldn't type because your dad just died, so you had to go get a job.
Oh, that's in Dominion Bridge across from Ganawagi, over the other side of the St. Lawrence River. I went and got a job. I was 13 and I lied about my age.
How old did you say you were?
Well, I said I was 16.
And you're, yeah, I guess
you I was 13.
Did you look 16 though?
I don't think so,
not
but
really.
I tried. And I got this job.
Because your dad died the year before.
Yeah.
And you're the oldest girl.
Yeah. And we needed money very badly. We were all trying to do something, you know. Mm-hmm. There was 9 kids and it was hard. Very, very hard. I said, well, I'll get a job. So I get this job in the carpenter shop office.
How'd you get it?
They put me there.
I know, but where did you apply for the job?
I went to the company and I applied.
Did you apply at a bunch of spots?
No, that was the only one. I got a job right away.
Oh, nice.
So I started, and I started working there for $33 a week. Big money. That was in 1956. So then I'm sitting in there.
56, it was 53 then if you were 13.
Yes, it was 53, yes. It was just after my father died.
Yeah.
So it would be around 53 or 54. Yes, that's right. I was a little kid then. I mean, a big kid. So anyway, I'm sitting in there in the office trying to figure out what to do. I was supposed to type up these work orders and file them and all that stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sitting there, and one of the guys from Ganawagi was working in there. He was a foreman, and his name was Dixon.
Dixon?
Yeah, it was George Dixon, yeah. He comes in there, he sees me, he knows who I am, and he comes up, he says, do they know how old you are? I said, no. He said, well, and do you know how to type? Well, I'm going to learn. So you know what he did? This is how great he was. He'd come in when he was on his break or on his lunch hour, and he'd sit there and he'd type it all up for me.
So nice. I always
yes,
love that story.
Yes, he knew we needed the money,
mm-hmm.
and how poor we were, and he did that. And I always remembered him for that. What a great guy he was to do that. Anyway, so then I don't know who told on me, but they found out my age and they immediately fired me.
Yeah. How long did you wait there?
Not very long. Maybe a month.
Well, 33 times 4, so you made, not bad bank.
Just 100.
Over 100 bucks.
Just over. Those are my jobs that I had.
Well, what about the biggie when you got fired now? The big one.
From Indian Affairs?
Yeah.
Well, the reason why I got fired was basically because I'm a Mohawk.
Well, yeah.
You know. But I was... What happened was, this was before the Oka crisis in 1990. This happened in 1988. And at Indian Affairs, they did not like me, and they always tried to get me out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured out what to do. I figured I'll just join the union and do all this stuff with the union and go to all their courses and, you know, look, try to figure out how to save myself, because they were always trying to set traps to get me out of there. So anyway, and then eventually they got worse. They couldn't find any way to get rid of me. So what they did was, they didn't give me any work at all for a year. For
what
a whole
did you just
year.
Sit there?
No, I went down to the central registry and I would ask for files.
Oh, yeah.
And I would look for very interesting stuff and I'd read them.
Okay. Oh, so they wanted to force you to quit?
Yeah.
Or something? Like you got so bored you quit?
Yeah.
Really?
Yes. But I wasn't bored at all because I was finding a lot of interesting stuff to read.
Yeah, you just got paid to go read and basically read all the enemies, notes on us.
Yes. So at the end of every year, they would have what they would call, you know, they would bring all the employees of the section in and they would all have to report on what they had done all year.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't done a thing. But I was on the list, and we all met for about 2 or 3 days in this. And they had 3 people from higher up, you know, that would come and scrutinize us, and they would sit over on the side. And then the guy, the director there, Normand, he made a list, and he said, and what you have to do is you go in there, and your name is on the list, and then you would make a presentation. The first thing you would do is you would give everybody a sheet of paper, and it would outline what you're going to talk about from your report. You know, A, I did this, B, I did that, C, I did that. And then you would have a thick folder of stuff to corroborate it, you know?
Oh, like to be like,
to back
See,
up whatever it is
that I did this. That
yes,
kind of
that, yeah. So I had a friend there. She's a Huron. And anyway, she was one of the people that had to go in there. And you know what they did? They put me at the very, very last. I had to sit there and listen to everybody lying.
Because you knew they didn't all work?
Yeah. They all pretended to work. But anyway, so finally, after the third day...
The Great Pretenders?
So after the third day, it was my turn.
So you mean it goes on for days?
Yes.
Jeez.
You have to listen to everybody and all their bullshit. So then it was finally my turn. So I got up, I went all around the table, and I gave everybody a blank sheet of paper. They looked at it, and this is my report, this is what I did for the year, and I have nothing to add. Good day, gentlemen, and I walked out. They went, and anyway, Julie says, you should have seen them. She says, I thought Normand was going to cry. So about a day later, I get a visit from...
Normand?
Not Normand, from the personnel department.
His lackey?
Human resources.
Oh, human resources.
And he comes to see me. He says, I would like to ask you something. I said, what? He says, how would you like to go back to school?
No way.
I said, no, I wouldn't like to go back to school. Why? Well, you can get 70% of your salary and, you know, and everything would be paid
Jeez,
for.
They really didn't want you there.
No, they didn't. They're even offering me that. And I said, well, I don't have any interest in that. I have a bunch of kids and I need 100% of my salary.
Was I around? Oh, yeah,
yes, you were. So anyway, he said, so he goes, he leaves. So about a day later, he comes back and he says, well, he said, we can give you 100% of your salary. I said, yeah. I still don't need to go to school. Who's doing all this? He says, right from the top.
Wow.
I said, okay, prove it to me. I want to see it in writing, and I want to see a signature. So about a day or two later, he comes back, and he's got this letter.
From who?
It was from Harry Swain, the deputy minister.
Is he dead now?
Hope so. Anyway, I shouldn't say that.
Why not? But he wanted all of us dead.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. So he says, I said, I don't. So I finally said, oh, all right.
What made you?
Well, they offered me everything. I said, I want you to say in that letter that I can come back here to my job. Otherwise, I'm not leaving. Okay.
Jeez, you're smart. You covered your ass.
I sure did. So then, and also I want you to get me into a university. You do the work. You get me in.
Yeah.
I said, okay. So they got me into Carleton for the Canadian Studies.
Yeah.
So I started going to school. And I had you.
Yeah.
And I used to take you to school with me. You were like 2 years old, three years old.
I used to sit underneath your chair.
Yeah.
With my toys and my saltines.
So then it came time for me to do my thesis for my master's degree. So it was about the differences between the Ganarico and the Handsome Lake Code.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to study the situations in Aguzosne, Ganawage, and Ganasadage.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to go to all those places. So in the summer of 1990, I started doing my field work. So while I'm doing my field work, war breaks out on all those three communities.
Mm-hmm.
And I got caught up in it. Anyway, so I was there all summer, 76 days. And at the end, they wanted me to come back to work for September the 6th.
Well, they wanted you gone so badly, though.
Well, they wanted, but I was behind the lines.
I know, but
yes.
It's like they wanted you gone so badly, but now they want you back.
Yeah, they said I had to be back September the 6th. And I said, well, I want to use up my vacation. I have like 3 weeks vacation. I want to use it up. So Harry Swain said no, he wouldn't approve it. I had to come back. But I was behind the lines. You know, the army was around us. And it turns out they had a sniper on me.
Yeah.
If I came out. And I certainly wasn't going to leave you and Wanique behind.
Didn't one of my cousins end up meeting that sniper?
Yes. He met the sniper in, I think, Queen's University. I think he was studying there. And this guy came over to him, Asanayadu. And he said, I was in the army, and he said, I was at Oka, and he says, I was the sniper that was supposed to take out Gahandineta Horn. That's what he told him.
And then didn't Asanayandu say, that's my auntie?
No, first he asked him, he says, would you have done it? And he says, yes. I was waiting, he says, I was wearing these things, earphones, and I was waiting for the command. But I wouldn't come out of the building. I knew about it, so I refused to come out of the building. So you couldn't shoot me and kill me. Anyway, so then Asanayandu says, he says, you know that's my aunt. He looked at him. He says, that's my father's sister. And that guy looked at him. And apparently later on he had a mental breakdown.
Yeah.
Because suddenly he's faced with a human
reality,
being,
yeah.
The reality of it.
That it's this target is actually the anti or the blood of this person that you're standing in front of.
Yes, and while I was in there, I got fired from my job.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that Swain that fired me. I mean, you know, he orchestrated the whole thing. Anyway. And not only did I get fired, but, you know, Blake got fired too.
Did he work there?
He worked there.
Oh, is that where you met?
Yeah, well, we know each other.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he got, just about all the Mohawks got fired.
Really?
Yeah. And then after I took the case to court, and I won, because they fired me because of racism. Then they had no choice. They had to take me back.
Oh, yeah.
But then they appealed it. So I was back there at Indian Affairs.
I remember that.
Yeah, I went back there.
I hated that.
Yes.
Because we had already moved back to Ganawaga, so.
Yeah, and we had no money, and we were living.
We lived on top of Wojo's.
We were sitting over a cigarette store.
Wojo's butcher shop?
Yeah.
No meat ever got butchered.
And boy, they were jumping up and down with glee over the fact of how hard our life had become.
Okay.
The hardship, yes. And they put as much as they could on me to make it harder.
Yeah.
And I had to fight and fight and fight them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I never stopped. What the hell?
Yeah. Feel for all those people who still work there.
I do.
Because you know, if some of them are in the same situation as you were, you just need to get a freaking job, you know? Didn't you say, what about when you got shown?
Yes, the war room. While I was at Indian Affairs.
See, pay attention.
While I was at Indian Affairs, one evening I was working. Not working. I was there. And this guy comes up. And his name was...
Bleed.
Oh, maybe I shouldn't give his name.
Okay, I won't put it
no.
in then.
Okay. Anyway, he said, Miss Horn, can I talk to you?
Wait,
I said, who are you?
Okay.
He says, I'm a soldier. He says, I'm in the military.
And what year was this?
That was just before 1990.
Okay.
Maybe 88 maybe. 80, before I went back to school, I was still there.
Okay.
And anyway, there was a guy named Nelson Smalllegs Nelson Smalllegs supposedly had committed suicide. He was a young guy against the Mackenzie Valley pipeline. So I looked at all that stuff, and then one day his father came to see me. Nelson Smalllegs Sr.
Did you find all of this stuff when you were not working in the files?
Yeah, but it was what his father told me.
Okay.
He gave me a whole lot of information.
But he came to seek you out specifically?
Yes, yes, he did. He says, my son did not commit suicide. He was murdered.
Mm-hmm. Where's he from, Smalllegs?
He was from Alberta, Smalllegs. Anyway... And he says, they've written it off as a suicide, and it was not. So, I wrote a letter to the RCMP, and I said, I have good information here that that was a murder and not a suicide. And then I gave what I knew, you know. So anyway, so this soldier came to see me. And he says, how did you know all that stuff? I said, I can't tell you. But he says, you know, he says, it's going to remain on the record as a suicide. He just told me that. Anyway, but he says, I want to show you something. So he took me to the 14th floor where the security was. And there was a big black wall, and there was like a cutout of a door that you could hardly see, and he took out a key and he opened it. And we went inside. All the windows were covered in black...
tarp or something?
Drape.
Drape. Not tarps. Yes.
And it was a big, huge place, and in the middle was a great big round table, which was covered with a green cloth. We took the cloth away, and it was the Canada, map of Canada, and all of the our communities were on there, and each of those communities had a little flag, and there were different colors. They were yellow, red, or green, and a lot of them were like green, meaning they're... I wondered about it. I said, what's this, you know? And, he says, in case there's an emergency. This is before the 1990 crisis. And this was the war room of the military.
Mm-hmm.
Indian Affairs is run by the military.
Yeah.
And that's the room that they had. Anyway, so all of the red flags were very much, you know, where I was familiar, like Kanawage and... Kanasatage and Aguzasne, Tayandanega, Six Nations. I saw the red flags along there.
Yeah.
And I said, why are the red flags there? He didn't really explain it. He had let me figure it out for myself. Then he showed me all these computers. And I said, what's that for? He says, well, we just feed information in there about everybody and every single thing on the reserve. Told me that.
Now it's probably way more high-tech and...
Oh, yes. So, anyway, so that was my visit to the war room.
That's scary. I guess that war room was all full during 90.
Well,
Bleep
said that they were working on making it more soundproof and all that. And they had, he says, the military were coming in and out of there.
Really?
Mm-hmm. They're coming in every day, and they'd be there all day. They were running the war against us in Gunnazadage.
And I was asking it too, because it was bad at that time,
eh? Yeah. And I told people about it. But nobody else had ever seen it. I was the only one that ever saw it.
Yeah.
And it was because that guy told... That's why I don't want to give his name. He showed it to me.
Yeah.
So when that war happened in 1990, I knew that that's where the command post was.
Mm-hmm. That's so gross. You know?
Well, you know what? I've talked about it, and people should know about it.
Yeah.
We should know about
this.
It.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, the war room, everyone. Is it really that surprising? I went over this episode with my mother, and a part of me got really nervous to talk about OCA, the war room, and the government. I want people to know that this isn't some propaganda-making machine or anything, okay? It's a glimpse into what we talk about, and OCA was a huge part of a lot of people's lives, and in some ways, it still is. Ma assured me that she has spoken about the war room before and written about it and told me that it would be okay, so I'm not going to have the special forces on my ass or anything, although they probably already are, right? After the firing of my mother from Indian Affairs, my three older sisters, me, and my mom's lives changed drastically. We were moved from the city to the res all of a sudden, and I became a res kid. My older sisters had the not-so-easy task of arriving on the res as teens. The environment after the crisis of 1990 was very high tension. My community and people suffered from post-traumatic stress, and I believe in a lot of ways we still suffer from it. So, on that note, that's it for part two of Ma Gets Fired a Few Times, Foreman Dixon to the Rescue, and When Indian Affairs Really Doesn't Want You Around. Our next episode is one of my favorites. I know I have a lot of faves, but seriously, this is a really good one. It's called Ma Steals Larry, the Cree Baby, or Surviving the 60s Scoop. All right, that was episode two from season one. Again, we are very excited to bring you season two to all of our listeners out there waiting and who have been waiting for years. Nyawan for being patient. So links to our website and any other info can be found in our show notes. Be on the lookout in your feed for any upcoming episodes. Nyawan goa to my Ista for her stories, and to all of you fantastic people for taking the time to stop by and have some coffee with me and my ma. Wanaki wahise o koe kon.
Tokinigo.
Oh, and I reached out to my cousin asking him about that sniper story, and I got the details. Turns out the guy didn't really have a nervous breakdown, according to my cousin. I guess we wished he did, because then that would make him a human being, but apparently it didn't really faze him.
They had those partitions.
Wait, they wanted to what? They wanted to fire?
Yeah, but they couldn't find him.
Wait, what?
Nobody knew what he looked like.
Who was the...
Does anybody know what... Bleep.
Are you serious?
And nobody would say anything. Nobody.
Are you serious?
I am not kidding you.
Okay, wait, when was this? This was right after 90?
This was during that whole thing. They were trying to get him fired. They were trying to find him to fire him, but they couldn't find him because they served him with the paper.
Because he just used to hide.
Like I did, you know. I used to hide to go around different partitions. You can't find anybody.
When did you
And
do
he used
that?
To go around and watch everything. He'd go and watch, you know, and see what everybody was doing. But he was quiet, and he never said anything.
Yeah. That's so funny. But they were trying to... they were just trying to fire him because he was from Gunawan.
Because he's a Mohawk, that's okay. Why. And then, you know what I did after I got out? I went over to Indian Affairs, and I had a picture of Yasser Arafat. You know.
Yeah.
You know that. Yeah. I made a whole bunch of copies of it, and I just put underneath, is this Daisy? And I put it all over the building.
You put it all over the building?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
That is when you got fired?
I had been fired, and I had to go to Ottawa, and I had to go to the building. I was still allowed in there.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And then I went around and I put up those pictures all over the place. I just put them on bulletin boards. Is this bleep? And there's a picture of Yasser Arafat.
Oh my God, you're crazy.
He's wearing, you know, that thing on his head, and he's got a beard, and he's got that crazy smile, you know. Look for his pictures. Yasser Arafat. Is this bleep?
That is so funny.
Anyway, I used to do stuff like that all the time.